Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. I often find short stories about baseball like comfort food, easy enough to digest, usually filling, and leaving me with a pleasant feeling afterwards. There are some dishes you like to return to over and over again, but once in a while you feel like something new. That's kind of the philosophy behind Baseball's Best Short Stories, edited by today's guest, Paul Staudehauer. This is a slightly expanded edition from his 1995 release, adding a few stories and taking out a couple deemed not so much not up to snuff, but as a nod to giving new writers a chance to crack the lineup. I spoke to Paul Staudehauer recently about the seemingly incongruous positions he has as a university business professor and editor of a collection of baseball fiction.
Paul Staudehauer, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you, Ron. It's nice to be with you today.
So we have before us a new edition of Baseball's Best Short Stories, an expanded edition. It's not new. It's the same stuff as the 1995 edition, but with some additional stories.
That's right. There are eight new stories, and two of the stories were deleted. For some reason, they just didn't feel right for the modern age. So we took those out. The eight new stories I'm excited about, they're all pretty contemporary in nature, although some of them refer to the past. It's new, and although it's old, too, because there's lots of stories that were in the original piece. There's 34 stories altogether now.
Well, it's interesting you say that about the deleted stories, because certainly some of the things in here are fairly old. I mean, you've got stuff by Ring Lardner and Zane Grey. So why were those two sacrificed, shall we say?
Well, that's a good question. There were originally in the first edition, which was published in 1995, there were three stories by Ring Lardner, and he is one of the greatest short story writers of all time, and his particular interest was in baseball, although he wrote on other topics as well. So we felt it was a little bit much of Lardner. It was a good story, but not as good as the other two stories that remain in the book. The second story that was deleted is a story about a gorilla who is found to be able to throw a baseball at an unusually fast speed. And so this gorilla is brought to the major leagues by a couple of enterprising managers, and he pitches and he lives up to their expectations. He's marvelous. He strikes out batters right and left. And the problem with that story was that I was looking online at some comments about baseball stories, and I ran across a story that said that this might be in some way racist. Well, I didn't think so. I thought that was overdone. But I mentioned it to one of the ladies who was assisting in putting together the new edition, and she recommended that we look at the possibility of deleting a couple of stories, and I just happened to mention that one, and she went ahead and took it out. So, but I don't really think that it was racist in any way. But there you are.
Now that's interesting, because I had occasion today to refer to Men on Spikes, Elliot Azanoff's book. It was written ostensibly about a friend of his, Mickey Rutner, And Rutner was Jewish, but in the book his name is changed, and instead of coming up against problems of anti-Semitism, the character is made to wear glasses, which in those days, you know, you were suspect if you were an athlete wearing glasses. So in that case, glasses stands in for Jewish. So it just goes to show that, you know, if you look hard enough, you can find something in anything.
That's true. That's true. I know Eliot well, and unfortunately he died a few years ago, but he was a great writer. In fact, in a nonfiction sense, he wrote one of the greatest books, I think, of all time, Eight and an Owl's Hiss. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you consider, when you were putting this together, an entirely new volume of all new material?
Well, I got to tell you, it surprised me the first time around that there was such a high quantity of material available, and that made for difficult choices as to what to include and what to exclude. But in looking at the newer stories, I was surprised in a different way, and that was that there were so few really good quality stories from, say, 1995 beyond.
What do you attribute that to?
I don't know. I suspect that it has to do with the decline, to some extent at least, of the national pastime. There's so many other things to do, so many other sports. Last night I watched a soccer match from Major League Soccer. And so lacrosse and other sports that weren't given a lot of attention in the past are now rising to prominence, and I think another factor too is a lot more people are more active in terms of outdoor activities and not subscribing to spectator sports as much as in the past. So I think it may have something to do with that, but I was disappointed that I wasn't able to find more stories that were of the kind of quality that you could call best short stories.
You talk about quality. We often hear about sports in terms of a golden age, the golden age of baseball. Was there a golden age for baseball fiction?
I think there was. That's a good point. Probably, Lardner popularized the short story on baseball around a little after the First World War, around 1918 or thereabouts. And there were some pulp stories that were written after that. But I would say somewhere around the 1930s, 40s, 50s could be characterized as the golden age for baseball fiction. There were stories before and after that period, but I think the bulk of the stories in the book are from that vintage.
Did you have a specific criteria for what you included?
I really didn't have any particular thing in mind. One of the things I was interested in is whether there were stories written by really well-known authors. And it turns out that there were. And I guess this is because most kids grew up at that time playing baseball, and they had an affinity for the sport. And not all popular writers, of course, have written about baseball, but a surprising number of them have. And Frank DeFord, for example, George Plimpton, T.C. Boyle, Michael Chabon, these are names that ring a bell, I think, with most people. DeFord has a very enticing book, new book out. And so I was looking for that, and I was also looking for the source that a story was published in. If a story appears in a magazine like Sports Illustrated or The New Yorker or Harper's or even Playboy, it tells you that there's some quality there, at least in the opinion of the editors of those publications. So I looked at that too. And then, obviously, I looked at what I thought was quality, and that's a subjective thing, of course, that I don't have any particular explanation for, although I'm going to blame Ogden Nash a little bit. He's a poet, and here's what he said in a nice little limerick. There once was an umpire whose vision was cause for abuse and derision. He remarked in surprise, "Why pick on my eyes? It's my heart that dictates my decision." And that I think applies to me to some extent.
Now, what about your particular background? Your background is more technical, it's more business-oriented than literary.
That's true, and I have a doctorate in economics from the University of Southern California and chose to take the more practical side of economics and took a job as a professor of business administration at California State University East Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I taught there for 38 years, during the course of which, particularly around the early to mid-70s, I noticed that there were some changes brewing in baseball. The Jim Hunter case, Catfish Hunter with the Oakland Athletics, in which he became a free agent and turned around and signed with the Yankees and upped his salary to $1 million or so a year from $100,000. It proves that the potential for free agency. And then, of course, the following year, 1975, the two pitchers, Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally, played a year without signing a new contract and were declared by arbitrator Peter Seitz from New York City to be free agents. And that was the first time in the modern era that we had free agency. And being interested in industrial relations, labor management relations, that was kind of a natural thing for me to follow. So I did some articles and some books. And then I've always kind of had an affinity for literature. And I read a book by Ring Lardner called Roundup, which was containing most of his popular stories on baseball. And I was quite taken with some of them, and I thought, I wonder if there's anthologies out there that would have baseball stories. And I began to explore that and found that there were some very good ones. Jerry Holtzman edited a very nice book called Fielder's Choice. And so I kind of took some stories from some of the anthologies that I thought were the best. I did a lot of library research and wound up, as I said, with a number of good stories and then had to make some selections. So it's sort of odd how people get into things, isn't it? You start out with one thing and it leads to another, which leads to another.
Now, you've also edited similar volumes on football and hunting and golf and fishing. As a baseball snob, like I am, it's difficult to conceive that other sports have the same cachet as baseball fiction.
Well, I think that's true, Ron. I do think that the best fiction is really baseball fiction. And yet, what happened was this baseball book went over fairly well in the market. And so the publisher said, is there any other sport you might think about doing? So we did golf and then football and then boxing, hunting, fishing, and a variety of sports in two books. So there's quite a few altogether. There are eight, and then there's some non-sports books that I edited for them, too. But I was surprised that there's a lot of great golf stories, wonderful golf stories. There's a surfeit of excellent work on boxing by, again, some very well-known writers like Jack London and I can't think of all the names right now, but you would recognize them as giants of literature who happen to lend their talents to boxing. Ernest Hemingway wrote a good story on boxing. Hunting, too, has, I think, some excellent short stories that I had never heard of or thought about before, but they're out there, and I collected them in a Hunting's Best Short Stories. In fact, I would consider some of the hunting stories as among the best of all time. Hemingway was known to be a good short story writer, and his story, The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber, which is set in a Kenya, I think it is, a big game hunting, and just an incredibly good story.
Now, if I'm I'm mistaken, wasn't it George Plimpton who came up with the small ball theory of writing about sports? The smaller the ball, the better the stories?
Yes, that's exactly right. And golf and baseball kind of qualify in that regard. But as he pointed out, there are no stories on beach ball. And very few on basketball, by the way. There was hardly any on that sport.
You mentioned before you also looked at where these stories came from, the quality of the publications. Can we talk about that for a minute? What is the editorial process for putting a book like this together?
Well, you try to round up the stories, and then there's a requirement of getting permissions to use the material. And in some cases, you don't need a permission. The Lardner stories, for example, or Damon Runyon stories, P.G. Wodehouse, they were written so long ago that they're not considered to be things that you have to pay anybody for. They're in what's called the public domain. And that's great. You love to see those stories, especially if they've traveled well and would still appeal to a modern reader. But then there are other stories that, of course, you do have to pay a royalty for. And it's either the author himself or herself or a publisher or an agent that would typically be involved there. And sometimes there's a little negotiating going on. They may want more than I can afford to pay. I'm not in this for vanity purposes. I'm trying to make a decent profit on these books. And the most I ever paid for a story was Ernest Hemingway, $1,800 for The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber. And the publisher, which was Scribner's, wanted twice that. And they gave me a break because it was, I think, the 100th anniversary of his birth or something like that. And or maybe they just wanted an excuse to allow me to publish it and still get a pretty good fee. I did a book called Murder Short and Sweet about 3-4 years ago. And there's a John Updike story in that book that's just outstanding, and I paid $1,000 for that. But most of the time, it's about $250, $300, as little as $50 in some cases, or $100. So it varies. Elliot Azanoff, if my memory serves, charged me about $100 to use one of his stories.
Because I imagine that would, like you say, that would cut in your profits if you had to pay that too much in commission fees.
Yeah, and so far, at least, we've managed to make a modest profit. I think the publisher has, too, because, well, they keep asking me to do stuff. Although, there's been a change, a really significant change in the market. As you know, Borders closed over 200 stores, and people are reading books electronically now. And I could probably put something together on baseball that could be used electronically if they were only pieces from the distant past that would be in the eminent domain category. But the trend clearly is towards the Nook and the Kindle, and as the prices of these things drop, more and more people are reading books electronically and not buying them in a bookstore. So I've noticed a definite change in the market. My Dog Stories book, I thought, was very good, and the Murder book, too, but they haven't done as well as the earlier books. And I think that's because they're not available to buy.
Well, I imagine as things go along, it'll almost be like de rigueur to publish simultaneously in hardcover and electronic versions.
Oh, yes. I think that's clearly the trend. And but it doesn't so much apply to me because in the short story realm, publishers typically consider electronic rights separate from rights to use material in a printed form.
And also, since these aren't heavily illustrated books, obviously.
That's true. There's just some small illustrations in each of the books, a dagger for a murder story, or a bag of a box of Cracker Jacks for a baseball story, whatever. But no real artwork.
Do you have a particular favorite out of the stories that appear
in the baseball book?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a tough question.
They're like all just like your children. You love them all.
Yeah, you love them all. And how can you compare Beethoven with Mozart? I'm not trying to compare this book to that, but I would say maybe Richard Wilbur wrote a book called or a story called The Game of Catch. It's a very short story, and you may know of Richard Wilbur. He was poet laureate for the United States and taught at Harvard and Wellesley and Wesleyan. And when he reached his 90th birthday about a year and a half ago, the Wall Street Journal called him America's greatest living poet. So he writes for the New Yorker. He still does. I saw one not too long ago. And it's just a delightful little story about three kids fooling around playing baseball, and one of them gets up in a tree, and they're making fun of each other, and it's just a delightful little gem of a story.
And we've been talking with Paul Stadauer, editor of Baseball's Best Short Stories. A new expanded edition has just been released by the Chicago Review Press. Paul, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Ron. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Father's Day is just around the corner, and Baseball's Best Short Stories would make a wonderful present. As with David Anderson's new book, The New York Times Story of the Yankees, a collection of almost 400 articles, profiles, and essays taken from the pages of the paper of record, Anderson will be a featured guest on a future episode. And that wraps up another edition of the Baseball Bookshelf Podcast. I want to give a shout-out to Jerry from Belleville, Illinois, who is the randomly selected winner of Hit by Pitch, Ray Chapman, Carl Mays, and The Fatal Fastball by Molly Lawless. Next up is a copy of Marty Appel's epic Pinstripe Empire, The New York Yankees from Before the Babe to After the Boss. Appel will discuss his new book, which was reviewed by Jim Bouton along with Rob Fleeter's Damn Yankees in the June 3rd New York Times Sunday Book Supplement, at the Yogi Berra Museum's Author Lunch Series on Tuesday, June 26th. The museum is located in Little Falls, New Jersey, on the campus of Montclair State University. Attendees will get lunch and a copy of Pinstripe Empire. Call 973-655-6891 for more information or to RSVP. And remember, we love hearing from you, so please send your comments, questions, and suggestions to Ron at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com. So long, everybody.
Look out, Gabe. Here it comes.